The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Should the UK Bomb Syria, was recorded in the Scotch Room, London, in September 2015. The chair, Guardian journalist Emma Graham-Harrison.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I think we've got an incredible panel of experts here with personal networks in Syria among policymakers. So hopefully we can get a really diverse range of insight on what's going on in perhaps the biggest humanitarian crisis the world is facing at the moment. So we're probably going to cast it a little bit wider than the original concept, particularly with the developments that happened today. It's going to be probably a discussion a little bit more about whether Britain and the West generally should intervene in Syria. Is this working? And how it should intervene and what it would hope to achieve with intervention. We'll probably have a discussion among the panel for about 45 minutes and then throw the floor open to you guys for your questions. So let me just introduce everybody. At my side, we have Ian Black, who's The Guardian's Middle East editor. He has just come back from Damascus. He's probably the person who's been there most recently out of everybody. He has had a long career at The Guardian, including spells as Middle East correspondent, European editor, diplomatic editor and foreign leader writer. Then we have Natalie Nugared, forgive my not very good French pronunciation, who's a columnist, leader writer and foreign affairs commentator and was previously executive editor and managing editor of Le Monde. Next to her, we have Amawa Kaf, who is a British-Syrian political analyst and management consultant, a member of the British Syrian Society, and broadly speaking, backs the government of Bashar al-Assad. Next to him, we have Wael Aleji, who is also Syrian-British, a medical doctor and psychologist, spokesperson for the Syrian Network of Human Rights, which investigates and documents rights violations by all parties involved in the Syrian conflict, and is a member of the secular part of the Syrian opposition movement. And the final member of the panel is Julian Barnes-Dacey, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, previously one of us, worked as a journalist, and lived in Syria from 2007 to 2010, reporting for the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and Channel 4, among others. So I think we're just going to start. We've accidentally scheduled this talk on a day of really dramatic news in terms of what's happening in Syria. I'm sure it hasn't escaped anybody's notice that Russia has begun bombing in Syria. So I think we'll just start by having the panel's thoughts on the importance of that move and how it potentially changes the dynamics of what's happening in Syria. Who would like to start?
I'm happy to.
Go ahead.
About the recent Russian deployment, yeah. Do you mean?
The bombing.
The bombing today.
Yeah.
Well, you know, obviously it's a very significant incident. It highlights the ongoing support that Assad has been receiving from the Russians. However, it is unclear to me and to many people I speak with the real intentions of the Russians. Obviously, their immediate goal is to prevent Assad from falling. But what about their medium to long-term goals. This is still vague. We don't know a lot about it. Obviously, they are there to stay for a long time, but we don't know a lot about their vision for Syria in the future and for their vision and their perspective on a sustainable political solution for the conflict. So some analysts argue that there is some tension between the Russians and the Iranians, and there is a conflict of interest, especially between the two countries, especially after the nuke deal. Some analysts are speculating that the Iranians would have a more pro-Western approach. There are some indications that the Russians haven't been pleased with the way the Iranians handled the conflict in Syria. Something that they put the Russian interest at risk. Mm. They have jeopardized the long-term Russian interests in Syria, the way they handled the conflict, because they played the sectarian card, and their involvement, the Iranian involvement and Hezbollah involvement and other Shia militia from Afghanistan and elsewhere, these involvements have increased the sectarian tension in Syria. I don't think that this high sectarian tension would serve the Russian interests on the long term, because they have their own problems with the Caucasus countries and their home Islamist groups.
Ian, I mean, you've been covering the day-to-day in and out of this conflict for several years now. I mean, what do you think the significance of this development is, and how does it change things?
I think if we want to understand what the Russians are doing, I think you need to stand back a little bit and look at the big picture of international involvement in the Syrian crisis. The way I see it, there's quite a simple division. You see that the countries which support the Syrian government, who support Assad, primarily and most importantly the Russians and the Iranians, have been far more strategic, determined, resolute, and consistent than the countries which, to one degree or another, have supported the Syrian opposition. I think that's the key to understanding the international dimension of the crisis. Many people had high hopes of Barack Obama when he became president. Actually, at the time, what people thought looked to him to do was to deal with the Israel-Palestine issue. Well, he hasn't managed to do that, but I think many people think, and I'm afraid that I would agree, that meeting the challenge of the crisis, the war in Syria, has probably been his most conspicuous and most disastrous failure. We've all paid close attention to Syria recently here in Europe because of the refugee flows, the human consequence of the crisis. So to understand what the Russians are doing, and I agree with Wael, that it's not entirely clear, but any of you who, I guess if you, at this event this evening, you followed, for example, what happened at the UN just a couple of days ago when you had President Putin and President Obama, you had Putin expressing strong support for Assad. So what we've seen today is a Russian action that is described as being against ISIS. Everybody's against ISIS, right? I don't know anybody who supports it, and that's good. But are the Russians really just out to fight this extremely dangerous, unpleasant, vicious terrorist group, or are they doing something a bit broader than that, which is putting their military might behind President Assad? If they're doing the latter, it's hard to see how this military action will do anything to advance a solution that will end the war. If they're not doing that, in my view, then it's likely only to escalate, to complicate things. That would be my brief take on that.
Yeah, I agree. I fully agree. I would just add that I think it's terrible news that the Russians are now bombing in Syria, because any past experience that we have of Russian airstrikes anywhere is a disastrous precedent. Civilians will be massacred, and today there will be no distinction whatsoever, no effort whatsoever to distinguish civilians from supposed targets. Today, what happened is the Russians said that they were bombing ISIS targets. There are claims to the contrary from Syrian opposition groups, but also from European governments. The French made a statement very clearly today saying that this was not an ISIS target. According to some sources, there were over 36 civilians killed today by these Russian strikes. My experience of Russian military intervention in the name of anti-terrorism is Chechnya, which is a war I covered. And believe me, the scenes that I saw in Chechnya in the late 90s and mid-2000s are scenes that... what was left of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, was more or less like Dresden at the end of the Second World War. They will bomb and destroy absolutely indiscriminately, and they will claim that this is an anti-terrorist operation. What they are more likely doing is indeed protecting Assad, who had been losing ground in recent months with the advance of armed opposition groups. And so the Russian move comes, in fact, not really at a moment. It piggybacks on the international sense of urgency because of the refugee crisis. It piggybacks on that. It claims to be an anti-ISIS operation, but in fact, it's a protection operation of the Assad regime, which recently had been showing serious signs of weakness and military setbacks. That's
Amar. You know, you think Bashar al-Assad is the best ruler for Syria. Do you think this intervention is going to help support him? Is it going to be useful? Are you pleased with it?
First of all, I think I need to introduce the concept of Syrians who, from the very beginning, never really wanted to have anything to do with this revolution. All those who thought this was a direct threat to their livelihood, to their economy, and so on. And these people, from the very beginning, and this hasn't changed much over the past few years, thought that the best way to defend themselves against the perceived threats that they've had since the very beginning, or they thought about, is to man the government institutions. That would be the most efficient way of mounting a defense. At the end of the day, the reason why Russia is intervening as such in Syria isn't pretty much related, in my opinion, to whether President Assad is coming or going. I think it's pretty much related to their own interest. They've had, unlike the Western countries, who had sporadic and very individual sort of moments with terrorism, they've had very sustained clashes either in Afghanistan or Chechnya. Or let's not call it terrorism, let's call it Islamic extremism. And I think if they perceive the Syrian government to be falling apart, then they would say this is a sort of prelude of a further attack to their own interests, either in the region or up north. And actually, President Putin, like 3 years ago, he said they're starting with Syria and coming to Russia. I remember that declaration very well. Now, at the end of the day, Russia, I don't think they're pretty much concerned with all the labeling that is taking place and all the brand names. So ISIL or ISIS isn't really a target. Islamic extremism is. Now, what the West have been doing is that they've been arming, for example, something called the Army of Conquest in Idlib. This is one of the examples. And the backbone of that is Jabhat al-Nusra, whose leader can go on Al Jazeera channel and say, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda chief, ordered us to do this and that, and we're going to do that. He's our prince. So he's swearing allegiance publicly. And for that to receive American sophisticated weaponry whilst being listed as an organisation that supports terrorism or a terrorist organisation on the list of American, on the American list, is rather odd. So the Russians seem not to be very much bothered about all this branding. Islamic terrorism is Islamic terrorism, and we're going to fight it. So yes, today I understand that they've bombed places that are not particularly Daesh or ISIS, but they could easily claim that this is Jabhat al-Nusra or any other extremist group, and we feel threatened by it, just like any other group.
Julian, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you agree that Russia is just using ISIS as a pretext to get more involved in Syria to fight its own war? Or do you see things differently? And how do you think it's going to change the conflict?
I think it's hugely significant. One of the most significant events that we've seen over recent years in Syria. I think it effectively guarantees, I think, Assad's position in the short to medium term. I think it's clear that they are targeting non-ISIS targets. And I think it's very clear that the rationale for this intervention is to defend the Assad regime, which, yes, was suffering setbacks. And I think they've planted a flag very firmly in the sand saying Russia is behind Assad. And this follows up from the speech in the UN where Putin made this very clear. And so I think that at a time, at a moment when there was renewed talk of initiating a political process, where you had renewed questions, does Assad become involved? And suddenly that's on the table. For a long time, of course, the West was saying Assad cannot even be part of the process. Suddenly we've seen that being rowed back slightly. He can be part of the transition. Who knows how long that transition will be. I think the Russian position now guarantees that Assad will be involved in any near-term political process, because inevitably the Russians have to be involved, and there's no way around the fact that they are fully behind the Assad machine right now. So I think from a political, diplomatic perspective, it's critical. Assad is there to stay now for some time, and any sense of a political process that excludes him, which was probably already something too optimistic, is now clearly off the table. But I think also militarily, it's very significant. I mean, we've had renewed talk of, especially in response to the refugee crisis, no-fly zone. You know, does the West need to do more? Again, that's probably off the table now. We've got Russian anti-aircraft missile weaponry in Syria. The Russians have quite clearly said to the Americans, stay out of core Syria in terms of your aircraft. If you want to do anti-ISIS stuff in the northeast or near Aleppo, that's fine, but don't come elsewhere. So I think there are very severe restrictions on what Western powers can do, and I don't think anyone particularly wants to go to war with Russia and Syria. So I think, you know, that is just another reason for the West not to do more militarily. So I think, you know, for all of these reasons, it solidifies, it consolidates the Assad position. It leaves the West stuck because they don't have a political position to push now. They don't have a military position to push. They're not willing to take the risks that others are prepared to take. As Ian says, the Russians and the Iranians are so much more committed. I think the key question now is, what do the Russians do on the back of this? And I think there's two choices. Either Putin doubles down behind Assad, and you really see him using his air force and the fighters on the ground. I mean, there are advisors there now, I hear, to actually help Assad regain significant territory. Or, in a sense, this is the Russians making clear that Assad is not going anywhere, that the regime is there to stay, but they are going to use that position of strength to then enter into a political process. And I think, you know, if one is to be optimistic, and most of us have given up on optimism in Syria, of course, since a long time, but if there is to be any optimism, it's the sense that the Russians are saying, you know, deal with the fact that Assad is here to stay, deal with the fact that we're behind him. Now let's talk, you know, on that basis, let's talk politics. And clearly Assad has to be part of those negotiations. Today Putin said, right after these attacks, we need political talks. The Assad regime needs to compromise. And from my experiences in both Moscow and Tehran, both of those two capitals recognize that the Assad regime has to give something to survive. They both know that the status quo is unsustainable. Assad can't govern as he's been doing. So does Putin, on the back of this show of force, now push the regime to say, this is what we're prepared to give, and to open up a political track, which would entail the West and other regional powers, of course, having to say, you know, we're going to engage in politics that involves Assad, and accepting that he is going to remain in control of core Syria.
So you sort of addressed part of the question that we're here, the big debate, should the West intervene militarily? You said that you think it's probably not a great idea. I just wondered, obviously we could all probably give, or you five could all give an hour and a half presentation yourselves on this, but could you try and maybe briefly sum up your thoughts on whether you do think the West should intervene militarily and what they could do at this point? I mean, I think we're all coming into this in the shadow of very complicated, some people might say, failed interventions in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya. I don't know if people follow the news in Afghanistan, but a key city in the north of the country has fallen to the Taliban just this week after billions of dollars being spent there, you know, underlining that you know, money and good intentions alone don't guarantee anything in a war. So perhaps we could go back through everybody just briefly your thoughts.
Well, it's true, of course. I think everybody would agree that the crisis in Syria, 4.5 years long already, has been hugely overshadowed since the start by what happened in Iraq in 2003, and more recently what happened in Libya in 2011. And everybody, if you're in this country or elsewhere, and you're aware of that. But the debate is too often framed, it seems to me, as being about Western intervention. There is international intervention in Syria, and the intervention, as I said earlier, of the Iranians and the Russians has been more determined, more overt, more sustained than anybody else's intervention. Now, you can argue about the degree to which the Americans in particular have supported this or that bit of the Syrian opposition. Amar, I noticed you refer to everybody, you talk about Islamic terrorism. Well, that's your description of it, of course, but that's misleading, certainly in terms of the motivation of the people who set out at the beginning of the Syrian uprising, and they were revolting against what they saw as a dictatorial regime, and they wanted their rights. So to brand it all as Islamic terrorism is, in my view, incorrect and highly misleading. So there has been intervention from the start. It hasn't been effective. The extraordinary spectacle of the United States, the most powerful country on the planet, drawing up a $500 million program to train moderate elements of the Syrian opposition. And they produced, what was it, 4 or 5 armed men who were in Syria, who I think immediately surrendered to a better equipped and more extreme group than them. So intervention hasn't been successful. I would say that perhaps the greatest failure of international involvement in the Syrian crisis, and this involves Western countries and it involves this country too, was what happened in August 2013, when the Syrian armed forces, by all reasonable accounts, despite a denial by the Syrian government, used chemical weapons which are banned internationally and killed 1,400 people in an area just to the east of Damascus. At that point, the United States was poised to strike in some way. There was discussion of it in this country. And those of you who live here and follow British politics will remember that the British Parliament voted against intervention in Syria of that kind. So the question isn't, should there be intervention exactly, but the nature of the intervention that there has been so far with all its shortcomings. And the question remains, would it make any difference? At this point, I have to say, and I think the question is a pragmatic, not a principled one, would it make any difference? The answer is, probably not very much, because the way the thing has been constructed has been British RAF pilots are bombing ISIS in Iraq, but not in Syria. And the whole thing is inconsistent, ill thought out, and ineffective. So, no, I don't think at this point Western military intervention would make very much difference. But that doesn't mean that it's been a success story so far.
Yeah, I suppose to clarify, I should have said sort of step, you know, you've seen a stepped-up military intervention from Russia, stepped-up military intervention from the West. I mean, referring back to the original title, should we be bombing Syria?
I think we should only be bombing Syria if it's part of a political strategy to end the war, not just to target a particularly vicious terrorist group that has understandably horrified people the world over, in the West as well. But from a Syrian perspective, I'd be interested to hear from our Syrian friends here, from a Syrian perspective, ISIS is a symptom of the crisis, not the cause of it. And, you know, the statistics show, I think, that Assad has killed many, many more Syrians than ISIS has.
Well, perhaps we can. I think that is a key question: perceptions of ISIS for Syrians outside Syria, whether its role in the crisis. But perhaps we could just, I mean, maybe hear from you guys. I don't know if you want to go first, Wael, as you spoke such a long time ago. But just briefly on the question, you know, would you like to see a stepped up Western military intervention, specifically British bomber planes in Syria?
Okay. Before I talk about military intervention, I just want to make 2 points, if I may. Some regime's advocates try to present sometimes a quite deceiving argument in which they would say that this is ISIS, which is evil, and this is Assad. He's a dictator, he's bad, but you can do business with him. I think it is wrong to make a moral comparison between ISIS and Assad. People the Syrian people shouldn't be forced to make the choice between ISIS and a brutal dictator. There should be a choice for the Syrian people to decide their own destiny. Syrian people started their uprising demanding for freedom and dignity and democracy. So my friend Ammar said something here that those who supported the regime, they wanted to preserve the Syrian state institutions. Well, there are no institutions under Assad family. They have been ruling in Syria since 1970 by blood and terror. They turned Syria into family business that they can pass on from one generation to another. So
maybe we could come back to this discussion about ISIS versus Assad and the options for Syria, which I think is a really important part of this debate. But just to
talking
sort of
about military intervention, I fully agree with Ian. There was a missed opportunity when Assad used chemical weapons, but then the West didn't intervene at that time. It's far too late. When we say military intervention now, against who? Against ISIS? Against Assad? Or both? What's the purpose for the military? To protect civilians or to preserve the UK, protect the UK national security and interests in the region? As Ian said, the vast majority of casualties, civilian casualties, are incurred by Assad, barrel bombs and random methods of bombardment, not by ISIS. It's seven times the ratio is 1 to 7.
So for you're saying every 7 civilians killed by Assad, there's 1 killed by ISIS.
That's right. Since the rise of ISIS, and let's not forget that Assad has retaliated by military force, extreme military force, from day one. So it is wrong. It is wrong to make this comparison between Assad and ISIS and put us in this position to choose between these two evils. Now, back to the military intervention. Again, it's a very tricky situation. Now, the UK government is thinking of expanding military operations to include Syria, but we don't know whether the purpose of this expansion. Why? And how? We don't know a lot about the UK strategy.
So essentially, it's a sort of confusion. You know, you have the same confusion in British policy making that you've had.
I think there have been some pressure on the UK to increase its involvement. I don't think that this will make any change. ISIS cannot be defeated by military force only. And ISIS cannot be defeated by air force only. If we really want to defeat ISIS, then we will need a ground offensive. There is no appetite in the West at all to send troops. Now, this puts us in front of another option, which is cooperating with Assad army and the Iraqi army to combat ISIS on the ground. Well, both armies are corrupt and largely sectarian, and the way they behaved in the battleground...
Is it possible to turn off phones, guys? Sorry.
...increased sectarian tension in Iraq and Syria and gave rise to ISIS. So it would be if we, those who are arguing that the West should cooperate with the Iraqi and Syrian armies, then we would be defeating the object.
Natalie, do you offer that rather bleak take on what the options are? I guess that comes out against military intervention. Do you have any thoughts, and maybe a French perspective?
I'm not sure I can say anything prescriptive or even French, but I think because of the complexity of the problem, it's worth reminding ourselves of some of the chronology of what's happened. The West is intervening in Syria. The Americans have been bombing for a year now, as they've been bombing in Iraq, and a few Arab states are also bombing. So the question is, and the French have started bombing in Syria after having refused to do so. And why did the Americans return to Iraq and start bombing? Remember the sequence of events. Obama's whole take was, I'm going to pull out, I'm going to stop all these wars, I'm going to end a decade of war. And yet there he is in 2014, he's back in Iraq with his Air Force. Why? Remember the sequence. The ISIS groups had taken Mosul in June, I believe. But that's not the moment when the Americans started thinking about going back into Iraq with airstrikes. The moment they decided to go back into Iraq was when Westerners were beheaded. So it was a reaction not to an equation in the region and on the ground. It was a reaction to all of us, to our reaction as Western citizens in front of our TV screens. And I'm not saying that because I think it was wrong to react, but I just want to point out how, in fact, a lot of the zigzagging and hesitancy that Ian mentioned about Western policy on Syria and Iraq is also due to the fact that politicians and leaders are reacting sometimes more to domestic public opinion and how the Western media describe things and react to things than to a well-thought-through strategy. And equally, why did France start bombing Syria just recently? And why is the UK thinking about bombing, targeting points in Syria? Because, not because there have been, you know, X thousand more civilians killed in Syria. It isn't a reaction to the humanitarian catastrophe, which the Assad regime is the first and most important reason for. It wasn't a reaction to that. It was because of the refugee crisis, I think, the refugee crisis in Europe, which suddenly created a huge sense of urgency. And we, you know, as Europeans, of course, we react to this and to these scenes. Tens of thousands of Syrians pouring into Europe because they have understood that their country would not be sorted out, that peace would not be anything in the near future. And they are exhausted by living either in camps or in exile in the surrounding region. And, you know, and they believe that now is a time to having, you know, their own lives are you know, virtually destroyed. What they had is destroyed, but at least they're hoping to build lives for their children. I just want to point out these moments because I think my main point is that Western strategy on the region has only always been piecemeal, not thought through, opportunistic in terms of reacting to public opinion. And I think that the reason why some moments where intervention, targeted precise intervention, may have prevented the bloodshed that we saw unfold afterwards, those moments were missed also because of domestic political reasons. In 2013, when Obama gives up, which I think was a moment, well, I think it was a disastrous choice. I think that's a story that still needs to be told fully, how that actually happened. But he decides that he's going to go back on his commitment. He had made a commitment to strike at the Assad sites, military and chemical sites, after Assad had broken an international taboo on the use of chemical weapons against civilians. This is what the Assad regime did. Before that, only one regime had ever used chemical weapons against its population. It was Saddam Hussein in Halabja in 1988. And so when Obama decides not to go for it, why does he decide not to go for it? Because it doesn't make sense militarily? Because there's no legal basis for it? No, not for any of these reasons. Because domestic public opinion in the U.S., and he fears the reaction. He fears that this will kill his narrative of no intervention. And what's happened is that we've all been tired of these unsuccessful operations in Iraq 2003, Afghanistan 12 years or more of intervention. We've all been rightly full of doubts about these interventions. But I think Syria is a case where timely, targeted, well-thought-through action, having been abandoned, has actually brought more costs and cost more human lives than the notion of what I mean. and as far as intervention today means, I don't know what the solution is. I think anybody honest has to say it's unclear what the solution might be. But I'm quite convinced of one thing, which is that if we limit our policy to targeted killings of this or that ISIS militant in this or that part of Syria, without addressing the question of the massacres of civilians that are being committed by the Assad forces, army and auxiliary forces, if we don't address that, those massacres, if we don't address the question of protection of civilians in Syria, then we will only keep facing a growing ISIS problem. Because ISIS feeds, Assad and ISIS are a two-headed monster. ISIS feeds off the onslaught of violence that Assad has released on his own population. ISIS presents itself as a protector of Sunni populations. And ISIS attracts young people from this country and other countries because they believe that ISIS contributes to protecting people against all this violence. And so I think ISIS will only be reduced. I don't know if it will ever be completely eliminated, but I think it will only be reduced if the violence that comes out of the Assad regime is neutralized. And whether that means Assad is put aside, put in prison, which I think put on trial, which is I hope one day will happen, or whether there's a transition period where he plays this sort of head figure, but in fact others run the show and stop these massacres of civilians. I think the question of where Assad sits for a transition period becomes less relevant than how do you prevent the Assad killing machine. 250,000 people killed. This is the catastrophe of our times. We are actually witnessing the biggest humanitarian and the biggest mass killing of our time since the Bosnian War, Rwanda, different proportions, of course. But this is a mass enterprise of killing of civilians. And I'm very long, but I think that the violence coming out of the Assad regime is what needs to be addressed if we have any hope of solving what worries us in our countries, which is the threat of ISIS.
I mean, we've heard, you know, you've had there the sort of contrast between or how ISIS and Assad feed off each other. Well, and Ian both mentioned this sort of slightly false dichotomy or presentation of the conflict as being between ISIS and Assad alone. Several people have mentioned that the piecemeal nature of Western policy making in Syria. If the reality is that the best way forward for Syria is neither the Assad regime nor ISIS, and yet the West has not found any other realistic factions or groups that it can back, how does policymaking go forward from here? Anyone? I mean, or you know, do you disagree with that? If that's not a
no, I think you're stuck. I mean, I think clearly there are no good options, and it's very hard. I mean, I probably push back as much as anyone against the idea that you can do anything militarily. And I think Ian made the key point that the Russians and the Iranians will always out-arm us, you know, they'll go in deeper than us every time. And I think it's no coincidence that the Russians have made the show of force on the back of opposition games that have been sponsored by external backing in the north of the country through this army of conquest. I mean, the Russian escalation is a response to external escalation behind the opposition. And I think it's very clear that the fact that there aren't political constraints on the Russians, that for the Iranians this is seen so much more existentially, means that they will always go in deep with us. And I think, you know, the point about the West just not being prepared to do enough is so true. I mean, you talk about a no-fly zone, which there are potential merits to at this point, but it would only work if you would be prepared to put boots on the ground to actually safeguard it, because if not, it becomes a zone for another kind of messiness that does absolutely nothing to solve the humanitarian needs. So I think, you know, the West, until the West is prepared to step up, intervention is merely, I think, going to push the other side to up their own ante. I mean, my view, I mean, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head slightly, and, you know, one can't get around Assad and the regime and their supporters. I mean, I think that, you know, Assad is the source of most of the woes afflicting Syria, but he's going nowhere. And his backers are ensuring that he's going nowhere. Now he's weakening. He's moving towards a more kind of central Syria. And the violence that he unleashes fuels so much of what is happening. But there is a reality there. There's a fixed point there. That you know, one can talk to death about the need to get rid of Assad and that there's no solution without him. But unless you're prepared to own what that would mean militarily, one needs to stop saying that. And that means serious military escalation. That doesn't mean piecemeal arming of the opposition. It probably means an Iraq-style invasion. I mean, that's how you get rid of Assad. That's how you defeat the Russians and the Iranians. There's no way around that.
But there's also no prospect whatsoever of it happening, right?
No, I think down the line, I think ultimately Assad, you know, he
but
can't...
But there is no prospect of the kind of escalation.
No, exactly, precisely. Therefore, that is the reality, the political and military reality one has to deal with. And so if one at that point wants to say, okay, Assad is not going anywhere because we're not going to prepare to do what is needed, what is therefore the imperative? The imperative is somehow to try and de-escalate, somehow to just try and stop people killing, whether Assad is there or whether he's not there. You know, what else can you do? You know, the hopes, I mean, sadly, the hope of a democratic, unified, you know, secular Syria is gone. I mean, my view is that you, effectively, someone has to blink. And we know that the Russians and the Iranians won't, so I think we have to do that, and that means engaging with them on the basis that Assad stays, on the basis that Assad stays in a way that he's forced to give compromises, that begins a process where you try and stop some of the fighting in different localized areas, that then can feed into a cycle where actually people aren't joining ISIS, where actually there's an alternative, which is one of simple survival rather than, you know, hope of a better future. But it's dealing with the uncomfortable reality that the opposition are not strong enough and that Assad is going to be a major player, part of that process in the short term. Long term, he can't survive. Long term, he's not sustainable. And actually, I think there's a critical point here that, you know, you deal with Assad, you cut a deal with the Russians and the Iranians, you try and stop violence in some areas to just begin a process. Assad can't survive, in my view, de-escalation. I mean, the minute he demobilizes, he doesn't have the legitimacy, he doesn't have the capacity to survive.
Okay. I'm quite keen to make sure we have time for some audience questions, but just before, I'd love to hear from Wael, who I think, you know, we're saying here there's no alternative, it's either
one,
Assad.
I'm the one who have only spoken
okay.
once, you said.
Okay, apologies. Ammar, okay. Would you like to jump in first?
Yes, or, let me jump in first. First of all, probably...
But can we try and... I know everyone's been talking at length, but this applies to all the panellists.
I'll try to keep our answers
quite short, just so that people here can have a chance to ask questions.
First of all, I think Ian mistakes me for a government spokesman. I'm not, so... I've never said that everyone there who has arms against the state is actually a terrorist. However, there is no escaping the fact that Jabhat al-Nusra is a terrorist organization. It's Al-Qaeda, and it's there in Idlib. I'm terribly sorry. So I never said that that everyone who has arms... just ignore me. Not everyone who has risen arms against the state is a terrorist. However, Jabhat al-Nusra is a terrorist organization. It's Al-Qaeda affiliated. They don't hide that. They raise the flags. They have all these ideology behind them. And they are in Idlib, they are in southern Syria, in Daraa, they are even in Damascus areas and so on. And these are Muslim extremists that the Russians would want to have. Now, with regards to ISIS, let me tell you how an ordinary Syrian who have decided that this revolution wasn't a very good idea thinks. The best way to confront the likes of what happened in Iraq in 2003, which led actually to the creation of ISIS. It wasn't Assad who did.
Well, I promise. Right. Yeah. Sure. Just so everyone can hear what you're saying.
So, in order to prevent destabilization, which would lead to extremism, a lot of people who probably don't like President Assad decided to back the government. And the government and its institutions are actually still there and are still functioning. And it's not only the Ministry of Education and Health and what have you. It's also people who water the gardens in the street. They're still there. So out of people, one telltale sign actually is that out of every three people who left the fighting areas and took refuge elsewhere, two of which, that's two-thirds, have taken refuge in the government-controlled areas, and one took refuge in the neighboring countries in Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. So people in Syria are most willing to deal with the government, even though some of them might not support it politically. But the key point is we need to preserve the Syrian state. Now, here's what, going back to the issue of do we bomb Syria in the UK or do we not bomb Syria in the UK, I mean, what's the point? You touched on the issue of is it not absurd to bomb ISIS in Iraq and not bombing in Syria? Well, there's a key difference. Iraq asked for it, for British help. Syria hasn't. And this is also a key issue of the Russian intervention, because according to all the formalities and box ticking, it's actually according to international law. The Syrian government, the formal representative of the Syrian people, asked for Russian help, and the Russians are coming to do it. The Americans never have. Now, is any bombing, couple of tornadoes, typhoons, you know, dropping on this terrorist or that terrorist, is it going to do anything? Probably not. But I would actually ask for British and American intervention. But the main issue is, how do we preserve the state? So it's not an anti-ISIS-only drive. We need also to talk to the Syrian state. The Syrian state by far has the most intelligence on the ground. They know a lot of information, and they can guide people. And this is exactly what they're doing with the Russians. So in terms of preparing for a political solution, probably it is time to start coordinating somehow and actually talk with the Syrian government on issues like the refugees, for example. There are 8 million displaced people inside government-controlled areas, and the Syrian government is struggling with those. And I've tried to go to Damascus the other day with the Eid to visit my parents, and I tried to explore the Istanbul route, and the ticket from Damascus to Istanbul was 5 times higher than the other way around. That's how much pressure there is. So people from the government-controlled areas now, even though they had taken refuge in there. They're starting to head into Turkey, into Europe. And I think it's time people got to their senses and spoken to the Syrian government, or at least used the refugee issue as a step forward. Assad is going nowhere. Why? Not because he's the best person in the world. From a Syrian perspective, from those who supported the Syrian government, he was at the time and still is by far the most capable person of running a functional and an efficient system, even though it might not look very efficient. But actually, the alternative is much worse. And that's why Assad is still in place, and that's why he would remain in place. Not because people... I can report a lot of grumbling that is taking place, even in the high supportive areas of Assad. But he will be there for a time.
So I think there seems to be broad agreement between a lot of people on this panel, whether or not they like him, that Assad is a non-negotiable feature of the Syrian landscape for the time being. Just very briefly before we... Oh, okay, right, brilliant. Sorry, I was maybe listening to these guys. At least for the next few months. While just very briefly, so we've got time for questions, could you just, if it's not a choice between ISIS and Assad, what is the opposition? Who militarily can somebody like yourself from the secular opposition get behind? Who's fighting for you on the ground? Who should the West be backing?
Well, it's a very difficult question. I don't have
the
answer, I'm afraid. there is no secular military presence on the ground now. Groups that are fighting in Syria are mostly Islamist groups. Of course, we have ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam. Also, they are all Islamists. So there is no presence, there is no military presence for the secular opposition. It used to be the Free Syrian Army, but nobody in the West wanted to invest and support the Free Syrian Army and make it more functional. Unfortunately, it disintegrated, and the vacuum was occupied by more extremist groups. Now, having said that, well, yes, I recognize Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS as terrorist groups, but my question is that isn't Assad and Hezbollah and other Shia militia as sectarian and terrorist as ISIS? And didn't they use the same methods? Didn't they slaughter people? Didn't they burn people alive? Didn't they use chemical weapons? Don't they torture people in prison to death? So, you know, it is wrong. It is wrong. It's immoral to make this
Probably Europe is preoccupied with the threat coming from the Middle East towards them. Assad never posed any threat. Hezbollah never posed any threat to Europe. Neither did Iran.
They do.
But the
they
ideology
Assad,
of
Assad,
Islamism,
it
Islamic
was Assad
extremism.
Who used to train and recruit and send terrorists into Iraq to fight the West.
Well,
we all know, we are Syrians, we know what was happening. We know that Syria was the base
for
Al-Qaeda recruits from all over the world, from North Africa, Assad intelligence services used to take them into camps and then transport them to the borders and deploy them into Iraq.
Well,
so,
I know you both have a lot more to say on this, but let's give a chance for some questions from the audience. Because there's going to be a lot of questions, what I'm going to do is take three at a time, and then maybe the panel can try and combine their answers. The guy in the red tie had his hand up first, I think. And could you please try and keep your questions as brief as possible? Oh, and yes, if people want paper, please pass it down. So, go ahead.
Just one remark. The first most senior delegation which went to Damascus after the uprising consisted of the foreign minister Lavrov and the head of the KGB at the time. I concluded that the Russians were not going to go there to mitigate or to put any sense into the head of Bashar al-Assad. but I expected Grozny to be repeated in Syria.
What's your question, sir?
I'm coming to my question. I'll finish within 30 seconds. I think the West can do something by creating safe havens like they did in northern Iraq during Saddam Hussein when he attacked the Kurds. And once you establish those areas, no-fly zone, in that way you will not create Syria, the whole territory of Syria, apart from the Assad area of Latakia, becoming another big Grozny, and where people would only
so
opt
your,
for living.
So your question is, would fly, no-fly zones help?
No-fly zone, heavy and, okay. and safe haven.
We're going to have a woman next, if that's okay.
You've mentioned that the fighting opposition force is Islamist now in Syria. Does that mean that the Syrian society is Islamist in nature, or are we seeing Islamist groups or labeled as Islamist groups? Because the backers, if the backers are Saudi and Qatar, are Islamist, and therefore the Syrians who need weapons will carry the Islamist banner. You could see that if you've watched YouTubes from 2012, you'd see that a lot of young men who would make mistakes in grammar or in reciting Quran, claiming that they are part. So my question is, if you change the backer, so if the West puts more money behind and probably bring back the Free Syrian Army, wouldn't we have a fighting force that is not Islamist? And what is Islamist?
Okay, so the question then is this guy next. So I guess the question there is, is Syrians, well, maybe we can leave the panel to a bit, but go ahead, we'll sum them up at the end.
So I wanted to make a quick observation, which was that it seems like from the way the media represents the Syria crisis, and also how the panel spoke about it today, there's something that's quite clear but unspoken, which is that brown Syrian lives are much cheaper than white Western lives. And I feel like I got that vibe, especially when Natalie was talking about the fact that why we initially went in. And my point is that if we valued brown Syrian lives more than we as equal, if we just cared about human life, the loss of human life, then clearly Assad would be enemy number one and ISIS a distant second. So I just wanted to ask the panel who they view personally as the bigger issue and the bigger enemy to the West. Would it be Assad or ISIS?
Okay, so I think that the panel's actually sort of discussed that it is a really interesting observation. Thank you very much. I think the panel sort of already discussed pretty clearly who thinks ISIS is the biggest threat, who thinks Assad is the biggest threat, and who sees a mixture of them both. I agree it's an absolute tragedy that lives are not... I doubt there's anybody on this panel who thinks that different people's lives should be rated differently based on the colour of their skin or where they were born. I think Natalie was making an observation about how things unfolded rather than putting a value judgment herself on those lives or anything. Would anyone in the panel like to... We're just going to address those two questions. We've already talked a little bit about a no-fly zone. I don't know if anyone has anything they want to add, or maybe we've already covered that enough. And do we think that putting more... Does anybody feel that putting more money... Are there Syrians who are not fighting for Islamist groups who could be persuaded to fight if they were given arms and money?
If I could take the lead on that. On the no-fly zones, I think, first of all, the one that is mostly... first of all, the safe zone, proposed by Turkey, hasn't got anything to do with Syrians at all.
Well,
the no-fly zone that was proposed by Turkey hasn't got to do, or has very little to do with Syrians. It is about creating some sort of a geographical enclave between two Kurdish areas to prevent the Kurds from establishing some sort of entity. I think everyone is wary of the no-fly zone effect coming from Libya. Nobody wants the Syrian state, I think, to lose some geographical entity. They want to preserve the state, they just want to change Assad, having learned some lessons from Iraq and Libya. So I don't think that's much viable, to be honest. On your question, I think that's a very good question. One part of the problem we have in Syria is that Syrians, initially, they're not pretty much Islamic. However, part of the problem we have in Syria is an issue of identity. So since the Iraq War in 2003, the Saudis felt that they were going to lose, because of the demographics of Iraq, they were going to lose, and there was going to be some democracy in Iraq, they were going to lose to Iran. They're going to lose Iraq to Iran. And so they immediately went to compensate in Syria and Lebanon. And we started hearing very focused propaganda to the Sunnis in Syria, saying the Shiites are going to come and make you become Shiites and disturb your lives and so on and so forth. So part of the problem in Syria, part of the motive why people went very hard later on was actually that there is some sort of a majoritarian sense, as in, we are the Sunnis, we are the majority, so we need to be governing. Now, that was picked up by the likes of Turkey, the likes of Saudi Arabia, and so on. Had the very thin layer, if I may say, of the leftist sort of liberal elite couldn't stand the test of time, especially when the arming started to take place, because everybody was intent on finishing this as soon as possible. Any backing with money and weaponry is going to reinforce this sort of Sunni identity. And part of the struggle in Syria is to preserve the Syrian state identity of whoever you are, you're going to become, you are going to be a first-degree citizen. And that's part and parcel of why certain group of people, not only the minorities, but also a large segment of the Sunnis, decided that this revolution wasn't a very good idea. So it's on the surface, it may look like actually a dictatorship, an authoritarian regime. Yes, the Syrian government, just like everybody else in the Middle East, is pretty much an authoritarian regime. But what lies beneath the underlying issues are issues of class struggle. So you had the rural areas against the middle-class urban areas, and some sectarian or identity struggle. The Sunnis who believed, or part of the Sunnis who believed, that, you know, we are the majority, we need to be governing this. But that sort of mentality, not every single Syrian would subscribe to, and that's what led to this clash.
Anyone else?
And what about the sectarian nature of Assad regime?
Can I just remind our panelists also to keep their answers?
Isn't it purely a sectarian regime?
Just like the question, so we can get as many thoughts as possible.
No, it's just a regime.
Oh, wait.
It is a sectarian regime.
A chance to talk. Ian, do you have any thoughts?
The no-fly zone. I mean, Saad, my friend in the audience here, asked a very important question about the no-fly zone. The Syrian opposition, particularly the Syrian coalition, the moderate, mostly externally based Syrian opposition has been calling for a no-fly zone for a long time, but it hasn't made any headway. They're still making that call. I think, and Julian referred to this too, I think the Russian move today makes it now almost impossible that there will ever be a no-fly zone. I think throughout this conversation, Amal here, another friend in the audience, asked about arming the Free Syrian Army, the more secular, the non-Islamist opposition. All these things are too late. That, I'm afraid, is the truth. And what the Russians have done today is to, you know, they've stoppered the bottle and they've hammered it so tight that it's now sealed.
But it's
and
been there tried. I wouldn't completely say we have. I mean, yes, we all know about this four American-trained Syrians in there, but there's also a covert program, and there's enough public information out there to know that the US is spending $1 billion a year on it. It numbers up to 50,000 Syrians. I think one in every 10 CIA dollar is being spent on it. And this is all public information. Mm. This is the anti-Assad covert training program, which, I mean, the public stuff is the ISIS stuff. We all know that's a disaster. But there is a, and but it also gets to the point that, you know, we are not good at this. You know, and the idea that you can micromanage a conflict from outside of it without committing, without trying to really go into it in a deep level, is something that we've failed time and time again over the last few years, particularly in an environment, and we haven't really talked about this, but this is not just a Syrian conflict, this is a devastating regional conflict. And we've talked a lot about the Iranians and the Russians, but there's also another side of that, and that is the Saudis and the Turks and the Qataris, who are not only fighting the Iranians, but who are also fighting themselves. And one of the biggest reasons that the opposition have been so weakened over the last 4 years is the intra, is the divisions amongst the external backers. And I just think, you know, just one last point. I mean, one of the main reasons why the West is now backtracking on the Assad question and getting cold feet is because of what some of our allies have been supporting in the north of the country. There's extreme concern about the coalition that is being backed, and that is from our allies and in terms of backing the opposition. And that is one of the main reasons that actually Western states have backtracked of late. So, I mean, you know, we're struggling to manage our own allies, and then one wants to start managing Syrians within a devastating conflict
zone.
But
it's too late, isn't it?
Oh, of course. That's the reality.
In answer to both those questions, I'm afraid.
I agree with Ian and Julian. I think a no-fly zone is out of question now. It's not an option. But back to your question about secular opposition. When the uprising started, you know, the uprising remained peaceful for 8 months, despite the extreme use of force by Assad. Later on, people started to pick up arms to protect and defend themselves and their properties and their families. And that's how things escalated into a full-blown military conflict. Now, the West has been hesitant in backing and supporting secular military presence. So the Qataris and the Saudis and even the Turks have stepped in and increased their support to certain elements within the military opposition, and namely the Islamic brigades. That's how things. That's why we ended up with this chaotic situation in which there is no presence, no military presence for the moderate opposition, whereas there is heavy presence for Islamic brigades like Ahrar al-Sham, not particularly Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, but I'm talking about other Islamic brigades. Let's not forget that the Syrian society is moderate to a large extent, but this society has been oppressed by a secular regime since 1970. This created some sectarian tension within the society, and that's why certain elements within the opposition reacted in a sectarian way to the sectarian behavior of Assad's forces. So when we talk about Sunni brigades or Islamic brigades, let's not forget that Assad regime is a purely sectarian regime that is backed by sectarian allies like Hezbollah and Iran and other Shia militia.
And Russia and China.
For different reasons, of course, yeah. Not for sectarian reasons.
It's the same reason.
It's more complex.
It's the same reason. Everybody's behind their own interests.
Let's remember that the Syrian intelligence services are run by Alawites. Let's remember that the Republican Guard is mainly comprised of Alawites. So the elite forces and the fourth Republican Division is made mainly of Alawites, and those forces have committed some of the most appalling and horrible sectarian massacres in Hama, in Homs, in everywhere. So let's put things into perspective when we talk about Sunnis and Sunni identity and...
I need to explain something very fast.
Okay, we've only got a few more minutes, so maybe we could take another round of questions and you could put it into your answer for that. Natalie, did you have something you were dying to say briefly, just so we've got time for more questions?
And I'm not Sunni, by the way. Let's... The
question. No, I wasn't assigning any religious identity to anybody. Yeah. I'm just keen, all the people who've come here, to hear from you guys. I'm really keen that they get a chance to put their questions to you, that's all.
Just on the no-fly zone, I'm not saying this because I'm French, but I did see a French statement which was not very specific, but it came from the foreign minister, and I think it was yesterday or this morning, saying that France was in favor of protected areas. So I think the notion, and I think that if there's any sense and any feasibility whatsoever in a no-fly in the notion of no-fly zone, it should be in protecting civilians.
French because troops on the ground?
No. I mean,
I'm asking though. Would Paris
I'm not a military
do you
specialist.
Do you think Paris would be politically able to put troops
I think
on the ground?
I'm not a military specialist. When there was a no-fly zone over Iraqi Kurdistan in the 90s. Were there Western troops on the ground?
Guys.
Seriously.
So I don't know. So these are questions.
Let's get a few more questions.
But I just think
that
the notion of no-fly zone is attractive because it potentially includes the notion of protection of civilians. It's about intervening for Syrian civilians, not for one specific armed group.
So let's collect up a few questions again. Do you want to go ahead?
I just wondered if any of the panel could give a few words on what Syrians in Syria on the ground, civilians, think about whether the UK and or America should bomb Syria.
Question at the back.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, how realistic is it for Assad to come to the negotiating table? Is he losing ground militarily and that he's being forced to the negotiating table? How realistic is that prospect of him coming to the negotiation table to settle the conflict? Or are we so far up from that that there's no sense of talking about military intervention?
Thanks. This lady here. Thanks for keeping your questions short.
Thank you. It's been very interesting. The only person that's mentioned a date went back as far as 1970. Do you think a longer historical view might help?
And should we have one more question for this round? This gentleman here.
In light of the very strong sectarian feelings and animosities which have grown up now in Syria over the last few years, the hatreds, do any of you see in a kind of a best of all possible worlds solution for that country? What would it be?
Thanks. So I think obviously we're not going to have time for everybody to address all those questions, but broadly speaking, people are interested in a reaction from civilians on the ground. I think we've sort of already discussed a little bit the question of whether it's realistic for Assad to come to the negotiating table. I think the panel have sort of said, if anyone disagrees with me, you know, feel free to jump back in. But I think the view I got was that he's in a position where his supporters probably would push him to make some kind of concessions. Would a longer historical perspective help? And perhaps this would be a question for the Syrians. Is Syria still a viable country after all this violence and hatred? And again, if people could keep their answers short, that would be fantastic. Maybe the panel might be able to stay a few extra minutes if you guys want to, but I'm aware that some people will have commitments. So. Do you want to just start? Does Syria still have a future?
I think a bit of leadership is and new ideas is pretty much what is needed at the moment. The essence of Syria is that, or has been since 1963, going back to a longer perspective, is that this is a country where, actually since we overthrew the Ottoman Empire, this has been a sort of country for everyone. We cannot go back to any arrangement. Nobody would subscribe to any arrangement where you have an excellent sort of status citizen and an ordinary or a lower status citizen. So new ideas can be developed, new leadership can happen, but in order for that to flourish, the environment of the war must end. So the what is important at the moment is that this thing ends. And this is what's, you know, gonna be, going back to your question, what civilians on the ground want is basically electricity, future, light at the end of the tunnel, more bombing that would prolong. Actually, if I can report on the government supporters, I think how they feel is that the Russian bombardment is going to hasten a political process. Reason being is that one big motivation for the anti-Assad forces is that the fall of Assad is imminent. So let's just, you know, do it one more day. And with the Russians now at full speed in Syria, that's not going to happen any soon. So we believe, and the government supporters believe, that this is actually going to bring the political solution nearer, especially with the lack of any vision from the West, especially the sabbatical sort of United States pre-election.
Wael, do you have any thoughts on the... Is Syria still a viable country, and what do Syrians on the ground feel about bombings?
Well, I would like to think that Syria, as a whole, as country as a whole, you know, is still viable. I think that Assad regime, the father and the son, have put the national and territorial integrity of Syria at jeopardy. And now Assad is fighting to preserve his rule in certain parts of Syria. Neil Rosen wrote a very interesting paper last year about useful Syria and useless Syria. And I think Assad is aware that he will never be able to rule Syria as before. And now he's fighting to keep... to keep his grip on what's called useful Syria, which is Damascus, Homs, east of west of Hama, and the coastal area. And the Russian involvement probably reinforces this this notion of useful Syria and useless Syria. They know that they will never regain control over the eastern parts and Aleppo. They don't need this. It's too chaotic. It is heavily populated by Sunnis. They don't need this. They want to keep useful Syria.
Anyone else on the panel have any?
I mean, going on that point, I think the future of a unified Syria is hanging in the balance now. I think it's, you know, it won't last much longer, and if it doesn't last, the implications for the wider region are quite significant. But I think the point you were making is probably, to my mind, the only possible hope, which is basically a regionally pushed power sharing based on what is on the facts on the ground, which is the fact that Assad has lost much of the country, that Assad... The Assad regime controls, with the support of the Iranians and the Russians, the coast, Damascus. The opposition get Aleppo. The Kurds get their area. And you have a weak, loosely configured Syria that holds broadly together. And I think we're, you know, there is potentially some ability by the regional players to start pushing in that direction. I think the Russians and the Iranians would actually support that kind of initiative. But beyond that, I don't see much hope, because I think there's no prospect of either side winning. And at that point, you're just looking at disintegration, and then that moves into Iraq, Lebanon, and it spirals and spirals.
Can I say that I think that this is a fascinating discussion, and I hope you all find it useful. I have to say that there's too much geopolitics and not enough human beings. You lady here asked about, you know, what people think. Earlier this month, I spent 10 days... In Damascus. It's very limited what you can do as a journalist visiting Damascus, because you're only in a government-controlled area. You have very little ability to meet anybody who is prepared to talk. You can talk to people privately about what they think. And my overall impression was of great fatigue, exhaustion, misery, despair, and a sense that the war must end. And that, I think, is the overwhelming feeling. We've all looked at the images of the Syrian refugees flooding into Europe. Young people want to leave. They see no future for their country. They think it's been destroyed. I met a 56-year-old surgeon from Aleppo who said, look, I know I'm too old, but I want to leave too. I can't live here anymore. Everything has been destroyed. So I think that the geopolitics matter, because they give us words and concepts to explain why things happen. But I think you have to see the human misery that is the great price of all this. Never mind the dead, the injured, the maimed, the destroyed lives. It's the lack of hope for the future. And I think that is the greatest factor that will lead to some kind of settlement in which Assad will still be there. And I think the most that one can hope for is that after the dust has settled, he will be shunted aside and Syria will be able to lick its wounds under a different leadership and recover. But for the moment, I have to say I see no other prospect. I hate to be so pessimistic and so desperate, but I'm reflecting what I saw. And I was only in places where I could go. I was unable, and no journalists are able to go to the places, the many places that are under siege by government forces, where there is starvation, malnutrition, death all the time, barrel bombing. You can't go there. We know about that from snatched conversations on Skype or whatever. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. So what I was able to see was in the relatively safe, secure part of Syria, where it's true, people have fled because it's safer there than to live in other areas. But it's not necessarily safer because ISIS isn't there. It's because they're not being barrel-bombed by the government. But that is the bitter truth.
And there are economical issues.
And of course, the economy is destroyed. It's destroyed.
Can I say something, please?
Something?
I fully agree with Julian and Ian. I just want to comment on something Ammar said. He said that the recent Russian deployment might facilitate the process of finding a political solution. Well, you know, politics is about realism and about compromise. Is Assad willing to make a compromise? This is a question we need to address. There is no sign that Assad is willing to make a compromise and give anything.
Pardon? Make him, he'll have to move.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You know, they forced him to give up his chemical weapons, and they can do it again. But are they willing to do so? This is a big question. Let's not forget that, you know, during the negotiations for the Zabadani truce, it was actually the Iranians who were negotiating on behalf of the regime. It wasn't the regime themselves. It was Ahrar al-Sham and the Iranians negotiating the fate of Zabadani and the truce of Zabadani. And the regime wasn't... Regime representatives kept silent all the time. And they only spoke when the opposition demanded the release of 500 detainees, who are mainly children and women. Only then the regime representatives said, there is no way, we are not willing to release a person. So this is the sort of regime we are talking about. If he is not willing to release one detainee, even a child, so how could we accept that this regime is willing to make a compromise and engage seriously in a sustainable political solution?
Natalie, did you have something you wanted to say just before we wrap up?
At the beginning, it all started, I think, on the 15th of March in 2011, and a demonstration started against Assad. And for 6 months, people were demonstrating in many Syrian cities for Assad to leave. They wanted an Arab Spring revolution like happened elsewhere, and there were many people. And this lasted rather peacefully for quite a few months. And then the regime increased, started police and military deployment, and people were starting to be fired at and killed like sitting ducks. And so eventually it turned into an armed revolt. The switch was roughly 4 years ago. It was in the autumn of 2011. But the uprising started in March. And Assad, at the beginning, said publicly that if this continued, the whole region would go up in flames and chaos. He said this, and he contributed to this happening by launching a full-blown war against many of the cities and the regions and the populations that had participated in this popular uprising. I think there will never be peace in Syria until the massacring and the killing that Assad has unleashed is neutralized. And whether that means Assad remains in one little bit of his palace somewhere or somewhere near Latakia, or I don't really care actually. What I think matters is that
somehow the killing machine that he represents is neutralized. And I think that is possibly one way of face-keeping for the Russians who say that there's no way they will condone regime change, but at least to get some kind of message through that the methods that Assad and his forces have used need to be modified, to say the least. When my neighbor here says that Assad is a good manager or that he's the best possible thing, you know, well, read, it'll be in tomorrow's Guardians. There'll be a very long article describing how someone whose nickname, whose pseudonym rather, is César, who was a military photographer and worked within the prison system of the Assad regime over the last few years. And he left Syria with thousands and thousands of photographs of people who'd been tortured to death since the beginning of this uprising back in 2011. And it's a poignant story of one man who decided that he would, from within the system, he would extract and transport to the outside world these pictures, and he tells his story, and it's it'll be in the Guardian. I just wanted to throw that out to you because, as Ian rightly says, at the end of the day, this is a human story first and foremost. It shouldn't be seen just as des pions, how do you say that, as little checkers, yes, on a great regional stage.
So. I think that's probably an appropriate place to end it, with a reminder that what we're talking about is the lives of many millions of people that have been ended or horribly disrupted by this conflict. It's been rather a bleak evening, at least for me. I don't think any of these options are particularly cheery ones, but I hope everybody feels at least they have some better understanding of the factors at stake and how things might play out. So I'd just like to say thank you very much to all the panel. And thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.